thank you so much for coming. I'm recording this for a future podcast. My name is Jeff Higgins. This is my wife, Cynthia's in my restaurant. It's Elaine's. We've turned it into a literary salon. I've interviewed over 100 authors so far, and I'm really looking forward to interviewing you, too. What a background you have. We'll see if it's all truth. As long as about half of it's true, it's so incredible. I'm really excited today to interview a Robert W. McGee. He works as a certified public accountant, accounting professor, attorney, banker, and consultant, and he's published 58 nonfiction books before becoming a novelist. That was 58, Tom. Along the way, he earned 23 academic degrees, including 13 doctorates from universities in the United States and four European countries, and he worked or lectured in more than 30 countries. He's a world champion in Taekwondo, because you had a lot of time on your hands, I would imagine.
A lot of time.
Karate, Kung Fu, and Tai Chi, both Yang and Sun styles. He's won over 80 medals in Taekwondo and gold medals in Taekwondo and Karate National Championship tournaments. His career gold medal count stands at over 900. He's been inducted to the United States Martial Arts Hall of Fame, the International Martial Arts Hall of Fame, the Taekwondo Hall of Fame, and the Who's Who in Martial Arts Hall of Fame. He spends most of his time in Fayetteville, North Carolina, Southeast Asia, and Europe. His first novel, Justifiable Homicide, a political thriller, addresses one of the most basic questions in political philosophy. When does killing political leaders constitute justifiable homicide? His first novelette, Annie and the Senator, a story of vigilante justice, I see a theme developing here, shows what a woman can do when a senator tries to destroy her life. You can find his work at robertwmcgee.com. So please welcome Robert McGee.
Oh, thank you. I should probably put one on him.
Well, that's it. Thanks for coming, everybody. So why don't you start off, before we even get to your book, I got to talk to you about your background a little bit. By the way, can you guys hear me back there okay? It's a little ambient noise here. Okay. Martial arts. What got you into all these different forms of martial art?
Well, I got beat up as a kid a few times. No, not really. I was one. No, once in a while, because I had bullies in my neighborhood, and there were three baseball fields just a five-minute walk from where I lived. And I wanted to play baseball, and sometimes I had to put up with bullies in order to do that. So when I got an opportunity, I started studying martial arts. And it wasn't a constant thing. It was on and off. I was on a high school racing team for 4 years, and I studied jiu-jitsu in high school for a while, but I had to drop out because I couldn't afford the lessons. And then later on, I started studying the other martial arts that I could fill out, and I went back. And when I was 65, I decided to get serious, and I started racking up world championships.
At 65?
65.
That's incredible. So how do you think we handle bullies now? Like that was sort of like a driving like influence for you, right? To make yourself stronger, be able to defend yourself. And now we kind of do the other thing, right? Is that a good approach? Is it mixed? I mean,
No, bullies have to be beat up. And I try to avoid them because nobody really wins a fight. You know, like if we had a fight and I knocked out two of your teeth and then you only knocked out one of mine, then I won, right? But really, we're both losing teeth. So nobody really wins the fight. It's just that some people come out a little better than the other side. Even when I was a kid, I tried to avoid fights all the time.
I mean, there's a lot of life lessons there, right? Like because, you know, some people only understand force. And that's sort of a part of being human, right? Some people can't be reasoned with. Some people don't respect anything else, whether you're talking about, you know, countries or leaders or the bully on the playground.
Yeah. Yeah, I learned that the hard way. But after a while, I could figure in advance that they were going to hit me. And so I tried to hit them first.
Were you reading body language in like junior high? Is that what was happening?
Yeah, I could tell from their body movements. They would move forward. They would get closer. And I could look into their eyes and see that something was coming. And so I decided to give them the first shot.
They teach that in law enforcement academies too, because there's a lot of like pre-violent behavior that people tend to exhibit, you know, probably the equivalent of beating your chest, but a lot of things when people are revving themselves up, getting ready for physical violence. That's impressive that you figured that out at a young age, but I guess survival will do that too.
Yeah, it will. And I was scared. I wasn't calm at all. And I fought out of fear, and fear is a good motivator. It helps me to, do my peak performance.
And so what's the secret to winning 900 gold medals? That number doesn't even sound real. That's incredible.
Well, it isn't real, actually. It's now up to 1,080.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, I got a lot of them during COVID because they canceled all the live tournaments, and so they started doing online tournaments either with Zoom or I would just make videos and send them in. And so I got a lot of my gold medals that way. But I also competed in two different circuits for about 7 or 8 years, NASCA circuit, North American Sports Karate Association. That was 9 to 12 tournaments a year, and they were all out of town. So I had to go to airports and, you know, pay for airfare and hotel food and all that stuff. And it got expensive, and I won enough world championships there that I decided to quit that circuit after a while. I was doing the Taekwondo circuit at the same time. So for a while, I was going to a different airport about every third weekend. And that got to be too much. So now I'm just doing Taekwondo and the occasional Chinese tournament here and there.
How do you stay healthy at like 65 plus when you're doing like contact sport like that?
I try not to eat too much, except sometimes, you know, I like ice cream. I like chocolate chip cookies. So before the Taekwondo World Championship, which is every July, I cut down on that stuff and I train harder. Not more than 1 or 2 hours a day, though, because that's enough.
In doing that, and also all those, what did I say, 23 degrees? How many degrees do you have?
23.
It hasn't gone up since we wrote that?
No, I decided to quit school at some point.
How long did that take you to earn all those degrees?
Well, I got my last one when I was 65, my first one when I was 22.
Wow.
I wanted to get 20 doctorates at one time, but after 13, I did a cost-benefit analysis. I figured it's time to quit school.
And do you have to do like a thesis for each one of them?
For most of them, yeah, a doctoral dissertation. For my law degree, a JD, that's technically a doctorate. I just did 84 semester hours of coursework, no dissertation. I had to write an appellate brief.
Is that all?
Yeah, that's all. It's not the same as a dissertation. But the other ones I did the dissertation. One of the dissertations was used by the Financial Accounting Standards Board to make Statement 86 on accounting for software costs. It was very timely. I was doing that at the same time that the accounting profession is trying to determine whether software should be an expense or an asset. Sounds like exciting stuff, doesn't it? Yeah, the software and an expense or an asset. And I determined that it could be either, depending on certain circumstances. And when the Financial Accounting Standards Board wrote the standard on that, they relied on my dissertation because I'd already done all the research for them.
What is it about? I mean, obviously it takes years and years and intense focus, and you're getting them in different areas. What is it about academia that drew you to it?
I guess I have to blame the Catholic school system on that. Yeah, I went through the Catholic system and they taught us how to be little philosophers, starting in about the fifth grade. You know, they gave us all these things about religion and philosophy, and we had all these questions, and the nuns would always tell us the question is to blaspheme. And so that made me want to question even more.
Yeah, of course.
And I went to them. It was an all-Catholic boys college, sort of. It was Gannon College at the time, named after Archbishop John Mike Gannon. In my senior year, they started admitting women, so that was nice. So there was one woman for about every 100 guys, so it didn't work out too well. But because they could get a lot of priests to teach for nothing or practically nothing. So we had to take a lot of theology and philosophy classes. And I became interested in those, religion and philosophy, and also history and political science and economics. And by the time I got through there, I was interested in so many things. I just wanted to get doctorates in all of them. But I had to work for a living, so I put off the PhD stuff for a while. But then when I found some extra time in my schedule, I started going back to get doctorates like 3 at a time.
So 3 at a time, you said?
It's more efficient that way.
Yeah, it seems like it. Right? Yeah. You wouldn't want all that extra time just loafing around.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, I would write a chapter of one of my PhD dissertations, and I'd give it to my supervisor, and he'd sit on it for 1 or 2 or 3 months. So rather than sit there and wait to get a reply, I would work on a chapter and another dissertation and then another one, and I just kept doing that. And so I was able to get 13.
Wow. In addition to like the inquisitiveness that kind of motivated you, did you have, was there like almost a meditative quality to study? I mean, was the actual act of research, was that something that brings you joy?
Yeah. I actually got in the zone. I was in a sort of like hypnotic trance, and I was doing research and writing. And I focused and I ignored everything else in the room. And usually it was a quiet room, so I didn't get too many disturbances. It was almost like writing hours in a trance, and without drugs.
What is the secret to that level of like accomplishment? I mean, it's really remarkable.
It's mostly just interest. I was interested in a lot of things. And again, I could win the Catholic school system on that because he introduced me to so many different subjects. You know, it started off with theology and philosophy, and then I just branched out into political philosophy and political science. And I grew up there in the 60s. Mm-hmm. There's a lot going on in the 60s, you know, political-wise. I saw it on TV, mm-hmm. and I saw some of my friends get shot in Vietnam. I mean, I didn't see them. I just heard about it. Yes, I didn't get into the Vietnam War or that. My lottery number is 346, so I didn't have to go.
Yikes. Yeah. I mean, that's good. So that obviously has influenced your writing later on, right? A lot of the themes that you're dealing with. Yeah. Why don't you tell us, just give us like the back jacket copy. What is Justifiable Homicide about?
Well, I'll give you the 5,000 word or less version.
Take it.
The dictators, tyrants like Hitler and Stalin, Pol Pot, people like that, it's obviously they need to be killed. But what if some tyrants aren't so bad? You know, how bad do they have to get before killing them becomes justifiable instead of murder? And that's what the book is about. And I wrote it when I was in Miami. I lived in Miami for a while in a Russian neighborhood, Sunny Isles Beach. So I get on the elevator, everybody would be speaking Russian. But then I'd go out in the street and everybody would be speaking Spanish. And so that's the location for the novel, Justify the Homicide, is in Miami Beach, Miami, Sunny Isles Beach. And where can I take this about 5,000 words? There were a couple groups of conservatives. Well, some were conservatives, some were libertarians. They wanted to make a list of all the politicians who were sufficiently bad that they should be assassinated. Mm-hmm. But they couldn't agree on the list. And they started fighting within themselves about what are the criteria that we should have for killing these people. And the protagonist is Robert Page, who is an accounting professor with martial arts experience. Why not, right? And he used to work for the CIA part-time while he was doing other things. And so he had CIA contacts in the Miami area. And one of his contacts gave him an assignment to sort of infiltrate and spy on this one group of left-wing professors who were plotting something, but they didn't know what. And so he did that. He infiltrated them, and one guy's became his friends. And then he learned later that his friend was on the list of people to be whacked. And so he had to prevent that from happening. But he didn't know how to do it because he didn't know who the assassins were. He had to find that out. And eventually he found out, and then good things happened.
So, I mean, your vigilantism, I mean, you're hitting on like a lot of kind of the core issues with it, right? If you're like, what are the conditions? Let's start there, where you think there is justifiable homicide.
Well, definitely if someone is like Hitler or Stalin or Mao or Pol Pot, those people, you know, almost everybody would agree they should be killed. But if they're not that bad, then there's no clear cutoff about how bad they have to be before they deserve termination.
Well, what about like existence of institutions that can deal with that? Like if you're talking about like a fascist government, obviously you don't, there is no recourse. But what about a government that's holding elections or a government that has multiple parties that can exert some influence? At what point would like vigilantism or murder outside of law, extralegal assassination, at what point would that become justified? Like where is that line?
Well, I looked for the line, and actually there's no one I could identify. And Hitler came to power through the electoral process, so did Mussolini. And after the declining fall of the Soviet Union, a lot of people wanted somebody like Stalin to come back because they didn't have a leader. And definitely Stalin should have been killed, you know, assassinated, because he was a bad guy. In fact, he was, I think he was ranked second. Somebody did a ranking based on how many people died because of these nasty people. And Mao Zedong came in first. He killed more people than anybody else in the 20th century. Stalin was second. And Hitler came in a poor third. But Hitler's getting a bad press. So
so when you have like, you mentioned like, you know, Hitler's elected, right? So when you have an electoral process, you have somebody, let's just say like hypothetically, someone's expressing the will of the people, but they're doing something within a nation state that, how is it that you would judge, I mean, would you judge like the immorality of what they're doing? Would that come from religion, or if the general populace, let's say they're 80% behind something that the leader is doing, but the 20% is maybe the targeted 20%. At what point does that assassination have, is there a higher level of morality beyond what you're seeing through like an electoral process?
Well, majorities can be wrong quite often. I mean, this is not new. Plato and Aristotle spoke about it 2,500 years ago. And in fact, Aristotle in particular, but well, not just him, Plato also, when they talk about the six stages, the six different kinds, and that democracy is one level before tyranny, because once the majority learn that they can milk everybody else for freebies, so to speak, that whoever offers the most free stuff wins. And we're sort of in that stage now. We've been in it for a long time, since at least the 1930s, and it's just progressed where whoever promises the most free stuff wins elections. Not always. It seems to be going a little bit in the opposite direction now, but I don't know how that's going to work out. This is a unique experience for the United States, where we're actually making an effort to reduce the size of government and reduce benefits and get people off welfare seriously. So, there's not much historical precedent for that, because usually after democracy is tyranny, historically that's been the case.
I mean, so you're talking about like the rule of the mob, right? You're talking about, it just whoever has the majority can do whatever they want to the minority. Well, let's say like in a place like the U.S. where there's multiple branches of government, which are supposed to have a level of checks and balances, where you're supposed to have a judiciary, even if it's broken, right? When you're looking at vigilantism, At what point do you bypass the institutions of government that were set to control this versus going outside of them and maybe never being able to get it back?
That's an individual decision. And some people have already reached that point where they think it's time to start killing people. And others have said, no, it's not that bad yet. Or during World War II, when FDR imprisoned 100,000 Japanese people just because they were Japanese, that's a form of tyranny there. But the majority of people agreed with that because Japanese weren't people. They were the enemy. That's the thing about having enemies. You don't think of them as people. And so that maybe he could have been terminated just as well. But some people definitely say yes. And there were attempts made on his life, but they failed. In fact, the first attempt was after he was elected, but before he was sworn in 1933. Instead of assassinating then Frank Sherman, the mayor of Chicago, instead, because they missed. It was a bad shot. Yeah. I'm not saying they should have terminated FDR. I'm just saying that he violated the rights of 100,000 Japanese. And he also, some people would say that he's responsible for getting us into World War II because of his foreign policy. He had a blockade against Japan because Japan was invading Manchuria, and FDR didn't like it. So he ran a blockade using the U.S. Navy, and Japan had to break the blockade so they could continue their invasion of Manchuria. And because of that, we have Pearl Harbor. So he could say he's indirectly responsible for the deaths of more than 250,000 Americans once he got into World War II. Plus, for everyone who died, 400 or 500 were injured, physically injured. And then they had a lot of what we now call PTSD.
So when you're talking about like this vigilantism, you kind of mentioned it earlier when you were having your characters arguing about, who should be on this list. It comes down to, if you're not going through like legitimate or legal institutions, who makes those decisions? And then more importantly, like once you break that institution, once you go outside of it, when do you stop and how do you ever get back to an institution once you've made the decision that it's no longer relevant?
I really don't know the answer to that question. They couldn't even decide on who to kill because it was most of the members of Congress and a few bureaucrats that they were thinking of putting on the list. And they didn't have the power to be really bad compared to the leaders of countries. If you're a member of Congress or a senator, no matter how bad you are, you can't do that much damage compared to someone who's a dictator.
And if somebody is doing a high level of damage, however we're defining that, if there's a system like they're voted in, like a senator, for example, there is a system to replace them. Is vigilantism more justifiable if they go through an election after committing the bad acts and they're still reelected? Or is it some showing that the system didn't work, or maybe we're back to the rule of the mob?
Yeah, and if it's shown that the system doesn't work, that these petty times keep getting re-elected, then the system is not going to get rid of them. So then the individual potential assassin has to decide whether it's time to take action. And they do it selflessly, too. They don't do it just for their family's sake. They do it for the whole country and maybe the world.
And they do it for the world based on their ideology, right? And so if you have conflicting ideologies, and people do, and people are equally, you know, feel that they're right about what it is that they're pushing, you know, once you go to violence, is there any way back once a society kind of devolves into this type of vigilantism? Because people like, you know, left or right or whatever the two ideologies that are conflicting, you know, like, you know, Islam and Judaism, whatever it is, right, wherever the conflict arises, they think they're right. So once you start fighting, how do you stop?
Well, in the French Revolution, the revolutionaries started killing each other because of the perception that they weren't revolutionary enough. Like they say that the revolution eats its own children, and that's why they say that revolutionaries turn on themselves at some point. Not always, but in the case of the French Revolution, that's what comes to mind.
So your character in this page, your character in this book, obviously has a lot of you inside of him. Mm-hmm. Is it just background, or is it the way he thinks as well?
It's also the way he thinks. Yeah, I thought that if I wrote a novel who's a guy mechanic professor with martial arts skills and a little bit of CIA background, that I could kill people without not getting arrested.
So it's a wish fulfillment this far.
Well, it's not a game plan exactly. I just wrote about things that were going through my head, and I applied the principles of political science, political philosophy, a little religion thrown in here and there.
How do you create characters outside of your protagonist who's kind of based on you and the way your view of the world? How do you create these other people? Are you creating them out of whole cloth, or are you basing them on somebody and then altering it? Tell us a little bit about how you create and develop these characters.
Well, some of them are a conglomeration of people I've met in the past. Like his buddies that he hung out with and had character traits similar to the people I met when I was doing these foreign assignments like in Armenia and Bosnia and some other places. And it was interesting to hear what their thought processes were, especially after a few drinks. They would tell me, oh, this guy really needs to be killed. What would be a good way to do it? Things like that. And there were also people that were in my novel that were flawed. And there's no one perfect except maybe Robert Page. A lot of the people are composites of people I've met. And the names of some of the people, especially the Hispanic, as there was a large Cuban population in Miami. I was teaching at Florida International University at the time. And I went through my roster. And I took the first name of one student and the last name of another student. And that's where I got the names for the writing characters.
I've done that, too. I've mixed and matched names. It's fun. Especially with two great names, right?
Yeah.
So are you cognizant of, like, what arc you want these characters to have when you're writing? Or is this something that sort of just develops as you are writing the book?
It developed. I showed a draft of the manuscript to some people. And they made some suggestions about you need to kill another person here because the action is starting to slow down. And I did some of that. And there are three sex scenes in it. And I wrote the three sex scenes. And then I showed it to my daughter over there. And she said, Daddy, these look like they were written by an accountant. And so she rewrote two of the three. There you go.
Is it awkward showing a sex scene to your daughter?
Not now. She knows more about it than I do. That's why she rewrote two of them.
I have so many questions about how accountants make love now. These interviews go in a weird direction sometimes.
By the numbers.
So like, it's a thriller. All right. Do you think twice before putting sex into a thriller?
No, it's a required part. In fact, the very first page is about it. In case you don't have time to read the whole book, read the first three pages.
I did read it. Yeah, I did read it. So you know, what are the tropes within thriller that you wanted to put in there? Like you mentioned your friend saying, slow down here, kill somebody. You know, like what are the things, what is it that your reader who picks up a thriller, like it's a political thriller, what is it they're looking for?
The people who are dissatisfied with the current political situation. Now, whether they're liberals, conservatives, left-wing, whatever, there's enough bad stuff going on for everybody. And so it probably appeals more to conservatives than libertarians than it does liberals. But I have liberal friends who like it too.
Are you when you're writing the book, are you thinking about that? Because obviously, you know, it's a very divided country. Are you thinking about wanting to make it something in there for everybody? Or are you just going in one direction and hoping people like it because it's a great action book?
I think about the reader a little bit, but not excessively. I'm not really writing it for the people. I'm writing it for myself. And if they like it, that's fine. And if not, we have 330 million people in the United States, and if only half of them buy it, it's still okay.
Yeah, those would be decent sales. Yeah, for sure. So how did you, like, when you're going through this, there's a lot of craft to writing, obviously, right? And fiction is different. When you're trying to work on pacing, when you're trying to work on this character development, how did you teach yourself to write fiction?
Well, when I decided to write fiction, I bought a few books on how to write fiction. And I took a few online courses, because they're offered all over the place. And I bounced the ideas off some people and some writers, some pretty good writers. They gave me feedback that you should do this, you should do that, you should set this or not that way. And after a while, after you talk to enough writers, you find out that they have different opinions. One person will say, do it this way. Another saying, no, that's no good. You do it this way. And then you have to make your own decisions at some point.
How do you get that compass as a writer, right? How do you know when the feedback you're getting is just wrong?
If the same people, if different people keep telling me the same thing, that's a pretty good indication that I should change or do something else.
Do you have like set beta readers for these, or do you use a writing critique group? What is how do you find these people to bounce it off, and how do you know they know what they're talking about?
Well, a lot of them don't. And in fact, when I was reading these books about how to write a novel, they said don't go to your friends and family, because they'll just say, "Oh, this is great stuff." And you won't get any good feedback. So I went to some people who knew how to read. And I told him, you know, just if you like it, tell me you like it. But try to find 5 or 10 ways or 20 ways or 100 ways that I could make it better. And so some of them came up with a little list. And I would compare lists. And if 3 or 4 or 5 of them said the same thing, I'd seriously consider making that kind of change.
Well, I'm actually surprised you didn't go out and get an MFA just based on your background.
It crossed my mind because Ford International University has an FMA. And when I saw one of the required courses was poetry, I hate poetry. I mean, poetry doesn't even rhyme sometimes. You know, poetry is supposed to rhyme, right, folks?
Yeah.
And it doesn't always rhyme. So I said, no, I don't need that. I'll just go with it now. And then a lot of the great writers never really went through an MFA program because it sort of hammers you down. It's the same thing when you go through a PhD program. They try to hammer you down so that you become mainstream. And a lot of people, by the time they finish going through that gauntlet, they're like a dime a dozen. They all think the same way. And some of the best people are the ones who haven't gone through that gauntlet.
So that's interesting, right? Like, how do you keep your, like, authorial voice when you're reading books and when you're getting input? And, like, people, you know, agents and publishers tend to look at something that was that succeeded and say, well, let's do more of that. So something is so far outside the box, and you hear this all the time, you know, how are we going to shelve this? Or you know, you're mixing genres, which now is very popular, but 5 years ago, everyone was against it, right?
Yeah,
so like, that's also a line, right? How much do you learn from, because there are rules of craft, and how do you learn that versus how do you just turn out the same kind of thing that everybody else is writing?
Well, I try to read the best authors, the best in terms of my genre, you know, political thrillers and assassination kinds of things. And I try to steal their good ideas and discard the rest.
Who are some of the authors that influence you the most?
Well, Barry Eisler is one, and Nelson Goodell. Those are two that come to mind. If I thought about it, I could probably be a half dozen more.
Did you have a craft book that helped more than the other, something you'd recommend?
Yeah, but I read them over 10 years ago. If you read 5 or 6 of them, you start to see a pattern. And someone will say this, someone will say that. I read some stuff by Hemingway. He gave advice. And a couple of pages of advice, he gave a little book on, you know, how to do things. And I don't write like Hemingway. If I did, I probably wouldn't be here, right?
What was it when you switched from a nonfiction? What was the most surprising thing to fiction? Like what I know you're probably anticipating a certain thing. You're a reader, you've read fiction, things you like. What was the thing that when you started writing it was either the most difficult or the easiest or that brought you the most happiness? Like, you know, what surprised you the most?
It was surprisingly easy compared to what I thought it would be after I read those books about how to write novels, because the first 58 books were about accounting, economics, taxation, things like that. It was highly structured. And so I learned how to structure things. And even in accounting, that you have an arc sometimes. And it's a linear thumb with an arc. And sometimes there are little side things you can put in there. And the same with economics and law, because I have a few law degrees too. And by the time I got through that process, I knew how to structure nonfiction. So I used the same approach with fiction. I structured the beginning, the middle, and the end. And lots of stuff going on in between. And every once in a while, somebody has to get beat up or murdered just to keep that level up. And when I didn't kill enough people in the novel, one of the people who read my draft said, you have to kill another person in this chapter because it's getting too boring.
So you know, going from that, I mean, the rigors of academia when you're writing all this nonfiction, did you find yourself writing the fiction when you're researching like locations or people or procedures? Did you find yourself trying to get to that same level of research where you knew it was right and it was something? Did you want a footnote as you were writing?
I did, but I resisted the temptation. I got a lot of the places that are in that novel and places that actually exist in South Florida. And when I would go to other countries, as I've worked and given lectures in over 30 countries, I would take photos of some buildings and some street names and things like that. And then I put them in a file and I can use them for the future.
Did you find it freeing just to be able to make stuff up, just lie in the book?
Exactly. Yeah, there's no need for footnotes when you do academic stuff. You have to footnote everything. But with fiction, you just make stuff up. And you have to make sure that it's consistent. And you leave a few things out so that the reader can use that in their imagination. And sometimes they can fill in the blanks. And they'll fill in different blanks. They'll see something one way, and another reader will see it a different way. And that's one of the things I learned by reading these books about how to write novels. Leave some things blank.
And that's different, right, than nonfiction. When you're trying to build an idea and back it up with evidence and your data, right, and persuade someone to do it, as opposed to creating the situations where they can, a reader can let their imagination work. I mean, they're doing half the work for you in the book.
Yeah, exactly. And in fact, some of the books I read about how to write a novel said you should do that, let the reader use their own imagination. Like you can give a description to somebody, but don't give a full description. Don't list the 20 or 30 attributes they have. Give five or six and let the reader figure out the rest for themselves.
It's sort of a magical process, right? Do you remember the first time that story really captivated you when you were younger?
I can't remember what story it was, but I used to read some fiction when I was younger. Now for a few decades, I thought, oh, I'm wasting my time doing this. I'd rather read things like history and political science and philosophy, the good stuff, you know. But then I started reading some libertarian fiction writers like Ayn Rand, for instance. I wouldn't say she's a hero of mine, but she's, you know, I like her writing style. And I was a little intimidated by Atlas Shrugged. I think it's 900 pages, something like that. Or maybe it's 1,100 or something like that. I bought it and I didn't read it for a few years because I didn't want to start. If I started, I knew I'd have to finish.
Do you consider yourself an objectivist?
Not exactly. Close. I don't know what label to put on myself. I'm basically a libertarian, but I have a conservative twist in there. And I tend to be an extremist, like I'm a free speech absolutist. And I'm not saying you should shout fire in a crowded theater.
Yeah, please don't do that here. Yeah. You have a microphone.
Yeah. But I don't see that as a free speech issue. It's really a property rights issue. The reason you can't shout fire in a crowded theater is because you can't whisper fire in an empty theater without the owner's permission. So I see it as a property rights issue.
Oh, interesting. So did you find, though, that like writing fiction, because, you said, well, I'm wasting my time. I'm going to read philosophy. I'm going to read history. But in a book like this, you're bringing up some pretty hefty ideas, right? And you're exploring them. Do you find that fiction is an easier place for readers to be able to maybe think about these ideas as opposed to nonfiction, where it comes with like partisanship and tribalism and all those other kind of nasty things, right? Did you find that's easier to get an idea across and play with it a little?
Yeah, it is. Rather than make the philosophical argument directly, I have two people talking over lunch or dinner about some issue, not only about who to whack, but about which way the country is going, which way it's not going, or, you know, what's considered a good law, a bad law.
And how do you, like, in a political thriller like this, how do you avoid, like, info dumping? You know, especially if you're talking about like a political debate and having two characters talking, because you want to get the ideas across, but you also have to keep the pace going. You have to put supply, you have to develop character, right? So how did you find any tricks to doing that, or were you aware of that as you were writing?
I was aware of it. Sometimes I had to edit things because I put too much information in a small space, and it started to be boring even to me. And at that point, I decided to cut back and just hit the high points, let the readers figure out the rest for themselves.
You know, we were talking about like this kind of letting the reader figure this out. And this, I really feel like it's a form of magic, right? Where the stories, where, and I ask all my authors, this is one question I ask every author. Where do you think story comes from? I'm talking fictional story. You know, how does it exist? I mean, writers talk about channeling ideas. You know, is it, where do you think the story idea comes from?
It's a combination of things I've read, things I've experienced. A lot of them. Well, I hesitate to say a lot of it's from my personal experience because I don't kill people and nobody can prove otherwise. Things I read, things that I would like to see happen, but the way I would like them to happen. And if I don't know, I'm probably going to assassinate a tyrant, you know? And there's a bunch of different ways I have to sort of figure out what would be a good way to do that without leaving evidence. Now that they have DNA and all this other stuff, it's becoming increasingly difficult to get away with murder.
You know, I'm wondering what your Google search looks like at this point.
I don't know. I probably the CIA has a file on me, but they have a file on Martin Luther King too.
So you're in good company then. But when you're doing a book like this, it's a political thriller. It's got an arc. You have a points you want to make and ideas. Are you outlining all this at the beginning? Is this something like just like a like an academic work, or did you just start writing and then and let the book take you where it would?
I just started writing. I know what direction I wanted to go in, but I didn't know where I would land. I didn't actually know how the book would end until about five pages before the end.
Oh my God! I'm just saying. I know there's another writer in here who's like, yeah, man, right on. But yeah, no, that just sends shivers up my spine. I mean, and did you have moments of doubt when you're writing this then because you don't know how the book's going to end? Or, you know, how long is this thing going to be? Is it going to work out? Am I going to have to throw out 40,000 words? Like, did you have these doubts?
A few, yeah, at a time. I didn't have any idea how many words it would be. I just thought I would keep writing until I ran out of things to say. And I ran out of things to say after 126,000 words, which is a little long for a novel because I read that the optimum novel is between maybe 40,000 and 80,000 or between 80,000 and 100,000 words. People couldn't agree on how long a novel should be. I follow Coelho on that. He writes everything. He writes as a bestseller. And his novels are about 40,000 words. And it's a quick read. You can read the whole thing in one day, and your interest is always piqued. So I was thinking for future novels, I might write shorter novels, maybe 40,000 words.
I mean, they used to be back in like the 60s and 70s, right? They were generally shorter and they kind of got bigger and bigger and bigger, but they're coming back down now. And I don't know if that's attention span deficits in the population or if that's the cost of paper, but it's, I think it's a lot of things. And it's different by genre, right? So thrillers can be a little longer, but generally you're hearing try to keep it up to about 100, you know, 80 to 100,000 sort of the sweet spot for that.
Yeah. And also now I'm thinking now about applying economic analysis because studies have been done about how much you can make per page. And the optimum is about 40,000, 50,000 words because a book could sell, a book with 100,000 words can't sell for twice as much as a book with 40,000, 50,000 words. So the longer the novel, the less you earn per page. It's an economic theory.
Yeah, no, I mean, that makes sense, but I wonder if there's other variables, right? Like you know, a longer book that engages the reader for longer might develop more loyalty, for example, and maybe you might want them to read something else. You know, there might be these other factors that aren't just cost per page that might make writing something longer better. The book might be better. You know, the book, you might be able to develop character longer, might launch a series more easily. I wonder if have we studied those? Do we have studies on this stuff?
Well, I read a few studies about it, but what I did with justifiable homicide, I just kept writing until I ran out of things to say, and that worked out pretty well. It's my first novel, but I think it's my best novel too, and I'm gonna probably keep doing that. But in the back of my head, I'll probably think about where's a good time to stop. It depends on what the topic is too. When I'm writing about, I probably won't be a 900-page novel like Ayn Rand. I just don't want to do that.
It's hard now. I mean, you certainly wouldn't get it published traditionally, and you know it's hard to sell or for people to pick something up that's that big. So it's a commitment.
Yeah, it is. And again, with the short attention span, because we have the internet, I think a series are shorter than these 40,000 to 50,000 words. And I could do more of them. I have like 30 or 40 or 50 ideas that I put into my hard drive every time I think of one. And I'm never going to be able to write that many novels if they're over 100,000 words.
Your series, I think it was after this, right? You wrote a three-book series, but they're novelettes. They're 18,000, 20,000 words, something somewhere in that range.
Yeah, I have a trilogy, the Rocky Hill trilogy. I've only written two of the three so far. The third one is in my head, and the third one is going to bring it all together because they tell the same story from three different viewpoints. The viewpoint of the perpetrator, the viewpoint of an observer, and the viewpoint of the victim.
That's a really interesting take on a trilogy because, I mean, trilogies, I think, are a little more popular now, too, as opposed to, like, unending series, you know, that are out there. But I had an author in here a few months ago, and he was doing the same thing. He was writing a trilogy, but each one was by a different character, you know, moving the plot forward. So that's interesting. Had you seen that before?
I think I have. I just can't think of the author who did it. There's a movie made like that, too, where three different viewpoints in the same movie. It was by a famous author. I just can't remember the author.
I mean, Pulp Fiction's like that a little bit. Is it Memento? Does anybody remember that one? Isn't that like that as well? Or that goes back in time, right? It goes backwards.
Which is written from about four different authors.
Cellist of Sarajevo.
Oh.
No. Do you see yourself doing more? Did you enjoy like the novelette size better because it's shorter and quicker? Did you enjoy that? Is that going forward? Is that what you're going to be doing?
I think I'll probably do a combination. I have more novels chosen for Robert Page, who's the protagonist in this one. And I did a short run on Annie and the Senator. She's going to be the protagonist in future novels as well. She's also an assassin.
And you self-publish this one, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, did you think about going traditional or with a hybrid or something? There's a lot of avenues to publication now. What was your thought process going through that?
Well, I went to, I guess you could call it a conference in New York, where they have all these agents and publishers waiting to meet potential authors. And I went through that whatever 60-second, 90-second elevator routine, and nobody was interested in justifiable homicide. So I decided to just do it on my own. And there's more freedom when you do your own books, too. You don't have a bunch of publishers telling you this isn't going to sell, that's not going to sell.
And there's really no correlation between their opinions on what will sell and what sells. And I've had many agents tell me that, and publishers will tell you that. There's not even correlation between the significant or major deals that they're doing in book sales. You know, they'll get more because of advertising, but they just don't know. And it takes so darn long. Like, how long does this take you to write? The actual just writing of a draft and then editing until you had a final copy?
Well, you phrased the question incorrectly. But if you should have stopped, how long did it take you to write? My usual answer is 65 years. So once I got started, it was maybe 6 or 8 months. But I wasn't working on it constantly. I didn't do anything for a few months. And then at some point, I said, I really have to finish this book. And so I banged out the last half of it in about a month.
And then what was your process for, like, editing? Did you use software to edit? Did you send it to an editor? How did you edit it?
Well, I used to be an editor for Pretty Solid and Hardcore Base and a few other companies you've probably never heard of. So I did the editing myself.
Do you find it hard to edit yourself because you know what you wanted to say as opposed to what you actually said? Did you, like, print it out? Do you see it differently on paper? Like, what were your tricks? If you're editing yourself is really hard. Like, what were the tricks you did, the techniques you used to try to catch things?
I looked for grammatical errors, spelling errors. If a sentence was too long, I was thinking about how do I make it shorter. One author I read said you should never have a sentence that's more than 16 words long. I think Hemingway said that. And so I tried to get shorter sentences, and if it was 18 or 20 words, it didn't bother me too much. But if it was 30 words, like some tax thing is over 100 words. You know, when I write tax books, then that.
100 word sentences about taxes?
Yeah. Yeah, well, one of the regulations say, one of the regulations, one sentence is something like 243 words. And so that's bad for novel.
Yeah, don't do that in fiction.
No, but I try to write short sentences. If it's a little over 16 words, it doesn't bother me. But if it's too long, I chop it up into two or more sentences. Maybe say the same thing using fewer words. And every time I go through it, I can find ways to improve it, no matter how many times I read the same paragraphs.
I mean, you'll get conflicting advice on that, but a lot of people talk about sentence variation, you know, paragraph variation. You want to see a lot of white space. You know, it depends on how much dialogue you're putting in there. Yeah. And then also it's like when you're going through action and things, to generally shortening sentences tends to increase pace all by itself just by structure.
Sometimes short sentences are better than long sentences. I think Hemingway said that too.
Well, he certainly wrote a book.
Yeah, he did okay.
Yeah, not bad. I mean, we're sitting here talking about him a long time later, right? Yeah. So you mentioned you weren't working on this all the time. It was sort of you've got jobs, you got degrees and people to beat up in the ring, right? You've got other stuff going on. Yeah. So what was the actual process? Did you write at a certain time of day? Do you have to write in a certain place, or can you kind of do it anywhere?
I have a little cave that I write in, and wherever I live, I change place a few times. I have my own room. Yeah, a room of my own. And I used that to write. I did almost all my writing in that room, whatever room it was where I was living at the time. And then the best times for me were either early morning or late at night. And sometimes I get an idea when I'm thinking about getting out of bed, and a lot of people have this because the brain is in the alpha state and you can think more clearly. And I just have to get out of bed, even if I only had 5 hours to sleep. And I go to the computer and write for a while, right, until I start falling asleep. Then I take a nap and do something else.
Have you ever decided, I'll just remember that when I get up and then it's gone?
It never works. Yeah, I keep the paper and pen by the bed sometimes so I can write down ideas without running to the computer, waiting for it to boot up.
Did you ever try dictation?
No. Maybe I should.
So, and do you write in Word, or do you write in Scrivener, or any of these other writing programs that are out there?
Word. I should get a writing program because from what I've heard, it makes things easier.
I'm a huge fan of Scrivener, so we can talk offline about that. Absolutely.
Okay. I should try that maybe.
Let me just thought we're running out of time here, and I'm going to see if anybody has questions too. But let me just ask you, like in the 58 books, is a tremendous number of books, so they're nonfiction books you've written. How is like getting this book out there and marketing fiction different for you?
Well, for the nonfiction books, I didn't have to market them because they were all with traditional publishers that do the marketing. And I really did a lot of stuff for Prentice Hall. I was one of the six people who wrote all the books that practitioners use. Whenever a new law comes out, they had to find out what it meant. So I was one of the six people who translated the law into English. And we would bounce things off each other. I would write a part, then I'd give it to two other people. And we'd make a little game of it, who could find the most mistakes. And no matter who found the most mistakes, we all won, really, because the final copy was almost perfect. And then when the thing came out and we read it, we found some mistakes that we missed. So it's never going
to
be.
I love it, though. That's a really fun, you know, fun way to do it. Mm-hmm. But everybody, every author on earth, the second they crack open their book, no matter what page they land on, they're going to see something. It's just the law. That's it. It has to happen.
Yeah. It has to have an end. You can't wait until it's perfect.
So what do you do when you're – because when you're a self-publisher, and people have different images of that, but essentially you're running your own publishing company, right? So it's cover and format and editing and the writing, and then you've got to get it out there. You've got to advertise. You've got to – you know, you get it. How do you get it into people's hands and get people talking about it? Like what has worked for you?
Nothing, basically.
Welcome to writing fiction.
Yeah. Well, there are places you can hire to do that for you, and I gave somebody a few bucks and a few bucks there, and they would spread it around. And sometimes I'd see a little blip in my sales, and other times not. And when I didn't see a blip in my sales, I tried somebody else. And it's a trial and error kind of thing.
I mean, the polls all show it's like word of mouth, like more than 50% is just word of mouth. So it's just getting people in there and talking about it. Did you do anything for like advanced reader copies or, you know, like NetGalley or any of the things where you can get your book into people's hands?
I sent out a few free copies to people who wrote reviews, you know, and it might have helped. If you do four or five things at a time, you don't know which one is working. That's right. The thing. You get a blip and you don't know why.
Yeah, I always tell people to do the A/B testing. Switch one thing, and then look and see what the effect is, and try something else, and do it. Because it is, you're right, it's hard, but also it can take forever if you're trying to market something one piece at a time.
Yeah, it is. You set the trial and error, and every genre is different, every book is different, but they have a lot of common features, and when they develop a readership, it gets a little bit easier.
Right. And so, does anybody have questions? I can come around with the microphone. Here we go.
Just speak up because we're recording this and I wanted to let me give you the microphone.
Vigilante and an assassin.
Oh, I think if you had to separate them, a vigilante who is someone who has self-motivation, whereas an assassin is somebody who does it on a contract, that's maybe not the only way to look at it.
So would you call Oswald rather than assassin, or John Wilkes Booth?
Well, John Wilkes Booth, he did it because he had internal motivation. And Lee Harvey Oswald, if he did it, he probably had him. Well, who knows, right? The Warren Commission report is bogus. Everybody's known that for years. But they don't know really. There could have been more than one shooter. That's what they're saying now. A lot of people are saying that for a long time. I think Lee Harvey Oswald is motivated internally, too. Yeah, he's been indoctrinated. He was a Marxist. He made it a point to say he's not a communist, he's a Marxist. To a lot of people, there's no difference, but to him, there is a difference. Marxism is a philosophy. Communism is maybe a little different.
About the kiddo who tried to kill Trump and Trump.
I really don't know why he did it.
Bad shot.
Yeah, he was a bad shot. I think he was self-motivated because he should have known he wasn't going to get out of there alive. And so you don't do that for money if you know you're not going to make enough to spend the money. So I think he was self-motivated. He could have been a tool that was used by somebody. They found him as a tool they could use. That could be how it happened.
Other questions? All right, Pat, where can people find you? Where's the best place to go?
RobertWMcGee.com. RobertWMcGee, McGee.com.
Awesome. Hey, so just if you haven't done it yet, please go on Amazon and leave them a 5-star review. It really helps it helps people discover the book. And it's good. And it's interesting stuff, too. And please do the same for Elaine's. We'd really appreciate it. Mom and Pop Restaurant, help us out. All right, Bob, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.